What's up, everybody? This is Dave Stovall, and you're listening to a Renew Audio Post. Randy Garris, the co-director of Ozark Christian College's Life and Ministry Preparation Center, thinks that the American church actually has its best days ahead of it. And yet, throughout this conversation you're about to hear, he talks about the church's coming season of exile. So just what is on the horizon for the American church? Exile or revival? Could the answer be both? Daniel McCoy and Randy talked about exile and revival, preaching and sustainability, and even what it looks like to lead a church in the aftermath of a mile-wide tornado cutting through the city and destroying 7,000 homes. So here's Daniel and Randy.
So I'm going to give you two words, and I wonder if you could tell me the connection that you draw between the two words that I say. Is there a connection that you draw between the following two words? Okay, so here's the first pair, church and exile.
Man, there's three or four ways you could go with that, Daniel. Let me tell you, the first one that jumps in my mind is probably exegetical. First Peter uses the word exile. It uses it in, if I recall right, it's in chapter 1, verse 17, and I think it's in chapter 2, verse 11, in which he said, I know you live as foreigners, as exiles. Well, what he's talking about is the church in the first century had been shoved to the margins. It had been pushed out at the edges because these are crazy people that masters would meet together and wash servants' feet. It's a crazy place that would let women come sit with the men and be equals. And so it was a bunch of odd ducks, what it was, at least in the sight of the culture. And they just shoved the church to the edges. That actual word exile, if you sort of summarize the Greek, it basically means not my oikos. That's all the word really means, not my oikos. In the culture, an oikos were people that were your household, your people, the people that mattered to you. And so, for example, when the Gerasene demoniac wants to go with Jesus, he said, no, you go back to your oikos, your own people. Well, the church in America, we've been a mixed up deal for quite a while. We kind of had a mixture of Christendom and Christianity, and we thought we were at the center of culture. Churches were wanted to be built down on, middle of town, and they wanted the preacher to pray at the openings of things and so forth. But as Christendom has fallen away and we don't have the cultural counterfeit, honestly, not as much, and the real thing exists, we're finding ourselves back where we probably always should have been and where we always were, which is not my oikos, not my house. And so one of the things that modern churches, just you go to any town in America, there's a lot of churches trying to find how do we get back in the middle of Main Street again. And First Peter says, embrace the margins. Embrace being an exile, because it's embracing that you actually find the power was not ever in our social capital. Our power, honestly, is something far deeper that exiles can do. And so don't worry about trying to collect social capital. It's okay to be a foreigner, an exile. Here's how you live. Jesus lived that way. The first century church lived that way. We'll be better churches when we actually figure out how to live as faithful exiles. And so that's where my mind goes, Daniel.
That is helpful. Here's the second pair, sexuality and wholeness.
I'm smiling here. I'm trying to figure out how you put your pairs of words together here. I've actually got an opinion here. I want to be careful that I don't go in directions that aren't helpful to people, but wholeness is what it means when I finally figure out my own identity and my own sense of repair from God. When I figure out that I am the shadow of the living God, same way on a bright sunny day, somebody standing there has a shadow. Well, God made me his shadow. I'm a lesser image of him, but that's who I am. And wholeness is when I look most like the Lord. And wholeness is when I know where I am attached and who I am. Sexuality is wonderful for somebody that has got wholeness. Sexuality is almost always a placebo to somebody who doesn't have wholeness. Our culture would say you have three personal needs. I mean, I'm just driving to the core. Three physical needs. You have a need for water, a need for food, and a need for sex. And until you satisfy those, you're going to actually be perishing. And so you get this lie. Well, Scripture and the way God designed this, sex is not a part of my physical drive. Sex actually is a relational drive. And it's designed for two whole people who are building a lifelong commitment, and there's a mystery in sex as it occurs, but it's designed for whole people. Well, the same way the alcoholic tends to run for a bottle because he's not whole, and it's not the taste of alcohol he wants. What he wants is the placebo in some way that'll manage it. We're in a culture that just keeps pushing sex off as it's the way to wholeness. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's the dead end. It's an incredible gift, and it's wonderful, and it's terrific, but it's not designed for people who aren't whole. Marriage is, quite frankly, you know, and the reason is just broaden this a little bit. Marriages are not designed for people who lean in life and have to have somebody hold them up. Those marriages don't work. Marriages are designed by two whole people who come together. Well, my sexuality, if we're going to use, you know, built around the idea of sex as opposed to just gender here. But my sexuality will be misconstrued and misapplied until I find wholeness.
Hmm. Marriage and batteries.
In our system, as we live in the Western world, and I think it applies internationally as well, but there are three basic systems for marriage that exist out in our culture. One is kind of a 1 to 3 year marriage. It's kind of a mechanism by which you believe that you fall in love with someone and stay in love with someone. The second one is kind of a, you know, 5 to 8 year marriage, might last 50 years, but all the life's been sucked out of it in the first 5 to 8 years. And then there's this kind of lifetime marriage where you're the couple that grows old together, and you fall deeper in love the more years go by. Those three systems are very different. I kind of describe the first one as kind of a AA battery. You put a AA battery in something, you can power it for a few hours, for a few days, maybe even a few weeks, but you can't power it very far. That's kind of what I would call the first system. It basically is the idea that if you meet my needs well enough, then I can't help but love you the rest of my life. Well, the truth is all of us married flawed people, and all of us are stumblers, and nobody can meet our needs well enough that we won't build resentment and a sense of, hey, we're not being treated fair. And so the AA battery just becomes a discardable thing. Well, that's number one. The second one is kind of that more than 9 volt. A 9 volt battery will last longer than a AA, but it comes to the same end. We've all got drawers full of used up 9 volt batteries, but we're not sure we had to throw them away or not. Well, that 9 volt is kind of that second one, which is we just have a chemistry. We just have a friendship. We just have a compatibility. We have common interest. Well, that's all. That's great. But here's the problem. No, none of us are rocks. We didn't marry a rock. And so you look up and 15 years later, personalities have changed and circumstances have changed. And the 9 volt battery doesn't make us be in love anymore. We begin to drift apart and we're kind of married to a stranger or something, and that didn't work. The only one that works, and this is not, I mean, this too short of a time to talk about it, but the only one that works has this crazy upside down thing that the gospel always does, which is you lose your life to find it. You let a man out of his worship. Now, I got to make that clear, but out of his worship, that he decides that he's going to serve his wife, that he's going to invest in his wife and take care of his wife, whether he feels like it or not. He does it out of conviction. God sort of winks and nudges the angels and says, watch this. He's going to be deeply in love with her. Because where your investment is, there will your heart be. And an investment can cause somebody to fall in love with their mate. And their mate can change in personality and common interest, and it doesn't matter. You just chase them right through that, and you keep investing, and your heart follows. And by the same token, that's what she's doing with him, and that's the couple that grows old. And so the 9-volt battery and the AA battery are basically situational loves. If you meet my need well enough, they're personality-based, they're common interest-based, and as we know, all batteries are ultimately discardable. Mm-hmm. I need something renewable. And renewable has to do with this idea of investment. Yeah.
Tornado and grace.
Nah. I can't fully explain it, Daniel, but the big Joplin tornado that occurred was, I guess, one of the top two worst tornadoes in the history of the United States occurred here in Joplin back in May 22nd of 2011. 7,000 homes were destroyed. We buried 161 of our neighbors. If I talk about it, I'm sitting here in my office and my lip will start bouncing. It's the worst thing I've ever gone through in my life. I held mamas that lost two babies and lost a husband. Mamas that lost teenage sons. I watched families with no houses. We had 300 families in our church that lost their houses. It's the worst thing I've ever gone through, bar none. And here's the thing that doesn't make sense. It's also the best thing I've ever gone through, and those two do not touch. I don't jump. I don't want anybody to jump ahead of me. They do not touch. I know that. It can never be the best thing, and yet it is. And here's why. Because I was blown away at the kindness of people. Joplin was restored for the most part because Christians came and stood with us. We were sometimes coordinating 5,000 and 6,000 volunteers a day out of our building for months. I'd get there at 5:30 in the morning, and the line of people willing to help us would not only encircle the building, but it would go all around our entire parking lot. We became a Walmart. Yeah. We became a Walmart within 24 to 48 hours with supplies. And the kindness of people, if I could build any statue to remember the past, I think what I would probably build is something that said the kindness of neighbors. And so the tornado was absolutely horrible. I could wipe tears here if I let myself. And the kindness of people redeemed it. It redeemed it in ways that I just can't articulate how grateful I am. So yeah, tornadoes and grace, they go together.
That's beautiful. For these, I wonder if I could give you one word and you could tell me what's the next word that comes to mind for you. So in other words, for you, when I tell you a word, what's another word that for you is inextricably linked to the word that I say? So here's the first one. Revival.
Holiness. Anytime there was a revival in somebody's life, I'm going to jump to passages like Isaiah 6. I'm going to jump to passages, well, like Peter falling down in Luke 5 at the feet of Jesus. They get a view of God that is not their normal view of God. We have a view of God that is his presence, his power, his omnipotence, and all of those are right words. But it's almost like it's a flat view. It's just a line drawing. But when they see the real thing, when we see the real thing, it's almost always blows us away about the holiness of God. And there is a revival. There is something that occurs internally. And so all the 4-part singing groups in the world, all the good preachers with good stories, all of the great flyers we put out, you can't do a revival in essence that you don't have people see the holiness of God.
Preacher.
Hmm. It's a grand word. It's a terrific word. And it's a misunderstood word. I'm not sure you've asked for one word. Maybe I would go privileged. I don't know. We have two different ways that word preacher goes. One is sort of the cruise director of an organization that we have in the Western Church. I'm not overly interested in chasing down where that word goes. It becomes a little bit, not so much even the CEO of an organization. I don't mean that as much. It's just you're running activities, you're making decisions, you're doing important things, and I get it. It's not a horrible word, but that's not the right word. That's not the right direction, at least. Preacher is the person who gets the privilege, and they have to have such clarity to go stand in a place and ask this basic question: is there a word from God? Is there a word from God? I think one of the finest stories I ever heard that clarifies for me what preaching actually is Dennis Kinlaw. Dennis Kinlaw was the president of Asbury College for many years. He tells the story of the first time he ever went to preach. He said he went to a Swedish Baptist church to preach his first sermon. And I think it was John 5 or John 6, if I recall right. And he said he preached his sermon at this very first church. And he said he thought it went okay. You know, 15, 20 people, this Swedish Baptist church. And he said when he got done, every one of them walked by and shook his hand and said, "You're going to be a fine preacher someday. You're going to be a good preacher someday. Keep it up, young man. You'll be a good preacher someday." He said, until the last old man. He said the last old man must have been a trustee of the church. He said he was tall, white-haired, dignified, stooped with age. He said the tall old man walked over and he said, "I thought he was putting his hand out to shake my hand, and I put my hand out, but he said he went right past my hand, and instead he put both hands on my shoulders. He looked me in the eye and he said this, 'Young man, next time you go and preach somewhere, please don't tell them what Dennis Kinlaw thinks. Dennis Kinlaw doesn't know enough to help anyone. Next time you go and preach, spend enough time on your knees over an open Bible that you know what God thinks. And when you know what God thinks, then you'll have something to go and say to people.'" I think we worry so much about so many things when in fact the craving and the only thing that really matters is, did I worship in the text that I laughed and I cried in it? Did I actually have my own conviction? Until that occurs, I have nothing to offer. But from that experience, something spills over. And so the word preacher, I would go privileged and grand, but it has to do with these ideas. What does God think?
Missouri.
Home. I've come a long way in life, about 30 miles. I know it's a multi-tribal area that I've fallen in love, and I care very deeply about some of the tribes I know. I have not got a chance to spend time with all the tribes in this state, obviously, and many tribes I'm sure I misunderstand. And when I talk about tribes, I'm talking about how just different groups have their own customs and things. But I love the state, because these are people that for whom Christ died, and they're people that are really lost, and they're people that are really, really redeemed. And I've got a chance to spend time with both. So it's just it feels like home. Maybe it's my oikos if I go back to an earlier discussion.
Sustainability.
I guess what I would jump into is when you do ministry, and maybe this, I mean, there's sustainability could go in so many things about families and everything else, but you asked me about the church earlier, so I'm going to stay there. All ministry at its core is really simple. All biblical ministry. It's really not running activities. They do that at Disney World. Church may run some activities, but that's not what we do. We're not really decision makers. I mean, Jesus never took his disciples by, you know, some great decision maker and said, "Be sure and imitate him." Everything we do is something related to the ministry of compassion, the ministry of prayer, the ministry of the word with people. That's what we do. But as a kingdom leader, you could exhaust yourself and spend all of your life doing those three things. And it would be wonderful. Don't misunderstand me, but there's no guarantee that it will sustain to the next generation or have any legacy. And so the fourth thing every leader must do is he must reproduce. He must bring along. He must in some way teach others who do the same thing you do. And so are you reproducing others? So you find me somebody who shepherds well and what with the ministry of prayer, ministry of compassion, ministry of the word, and adds the fourth thing, which is, and I bring people along and help them catch a vision for it. Now we have sustainability from one generation to the next. Now we have it when life begins to make its twists and turns. Mm. There's a sense in which you can make the desert bloom if you'll stand right there with a water hose. But as soon as you walk away with the water hose, the desert reclaims whatever it was. That's why churches and ministries often have this grand and glorious season. Man, that was our good season. But when so-and-so died or moved or whatever, it changed. Well, here's why. It's because sustainability got lost, because while good ministry was done, it did not raise up other leaders. No one is effectively leading if you're not creating a movement of shepherds. No church can hire enough staff to do what they need to do. You need to hire people who do things, but they're not effective if they're not raising up a movement of shepherds. That's where sustainability is.
Mm. Last word, grandkid.
It's a privilege. It's a privilege. I've got 9. I've got the 10th one on the way. And at first, you labor very hard just to establish a relationship with your grandkids, especially when they live long distance. And that's just a part for many of us. You just really want them to feel loved, and you really want them to know that they are more than peripheral in your life. But the older they get, and I've got them in high school now, the older they get, the more you work very, very hard. Not just that your heart they know, but you really want them to know the heart of the King. And so you pray differently and you invest differently. When I take a kid on a trip of some kind, I want to delight in them, but I also know that I'm in the fourth quarter, so to speak, of my own ministry and life, and I don't have lots of other quarters to do this with. And so you never want to get preachy. You never want to get preachy. My goodness, but what you do want to do is you want to be open and transparent and real in who you really are. And so grandkids are a chance for your own legacy to go multiple generations.
This will be the last question. Now that you're kind of in a fourth quarter season, what are you praying about with regard to the American church?
I think the American church actually has its best days ahead of it. I think my grandkids and, you know, your kids and grandkids, I think we'll grow up in a better church than we grew up in. So I pray it will discover that soon. The reason I think it will be a cleaner, better church is because there were two churches that existed. There was the sort of the Christendom church and real Christ followers, and they were mixed together in the same congregation, and it was pretty confusing for people, and it kind of neutralized the congregations in some ways. I think as Christendom sort of falls away and real Christ followers stay, I think you get a more authentic church. But we cannot study each other, and we cannot watch each other and probably figure out how to be the best churches. We probably need our international brothers and sisters who've been in this place forever. We probably need the Christians in India and the leaders in India and maybe Vietnam and the leaders in China. They're going to have to be our instructors and our teachers. And so if your question about prayer, oftentimes I'm praying, would we be humble enough to be taught by the international church, which will allow us to go back and see the scripture with better eyes and to see how books like 1 Peter and books like that told us how to be a church, we see them a little more clearly in the context they're really written. And so I'm praying for a humble church that's teachable by the international church so we can see scripture in some ways and live it out. I honestly think good days are ahead of us. It's going to have kind of a painful journey in between, probably, for some congregations, but I think it's headed in the right direction.